Welcome to episode 181 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Christoph Koch. Christoph is a neurophysiologist and computational neuroscientist, best known for his work on the neural basis of consciousness, on which he worked with Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick for 24 years. He's the president and chief scientist of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. Christoph describes his passion in life as, "To understand how I came to be in this wonderful, mysterious universe. Not so much me personally, but me as a conscious, experiencing thing surrounded by other conscious organisms and trees, stars, and the sea." Over the last decade, he's worked closely with the psychiatrist and neuroscientist Giulio Tononi. Together, they work on an integrated information theory of consciousness, often seen as a modern version of panpsychism, that ascribes consciousness to entities with some degree of irreducible cause-effect power. Christoph is the author of the books Consciousness, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist, The Quest for Consciousness, A Neurobiological Approach, and Biophysics of Computation, Information Processing in Single Neurons. His next book, Then I Am Myself the World, is due out in 2024. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 180 others in our timeless back catalogue. Why not let me know via review or rating? Reviews, ratings, and sharing really help more people find out about the Sentientism worldview, hopefully nudging the world towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite social media platform. You've been made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening.
I dedicated this book to all fellow travelers on the river of time who howl, bark, cry, screech, whine, bellow, shriek, buzz, sing, speak, or without a voice. For it is only in compassion with all life that we can redeem ourselves. I think that's the great sin that our modern civilization does. You know, we think ourselves morally so superior than our previous because we recognize, you know, racism and misogyny and other types of ism. But then we have this large-scale industrial production of animals, billions of animals every day that we slaughter and keep under totally inhumane conditions. We could get rid of it, but we don't. You're just in this state of being. Yes, computation is useful. Yes, computers do it. Yes, under certain views, you can also think of the brain as doing computation. That's sort of the entire modern paradigm. But consciousness, it's not a computation.
Good morning, Christoph. How are you?
Good morning, Jamie.
We both have our coffee. You're drinking yours early in the Seattle morning and I'm drinking mine probably too late in the London day, but we match up. Yeah. And I love the dog mug too.
My dog, Bernese Mountain Dog, Mr. Felix.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
A sentient being.
Absolutely. I think our family sentient being is roaming around at the moment, so she might make a guest appearance later on too. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the Sentientism podcast and YouTube. It's an honor to have you here, given your work. And we tend to focus very strongly on, I guess, naturalism as an epistemology, but also the deep questions of ethics. And I guess your life's mission really has been trying to understand a phenomenon that sits at the intersection of those two things, the idea of consciousness and sentience. So in addition to our usual questions, it's going to be fascinating to dig into your latest thinking about what consciousness and sentience actually are and how they came to be. As you know already, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the most fundamental and most important philosophical questions, also ones that so far most of humanity gets wrong. The questions of what's real and how to go about working out what we should believe, questions of ontology and epistemology, but just as importantly, the big questions of ethics and who gets to matter in our moral scope. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really pluralistic, simple worldview called sentientism that I summarize as evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So when it comes to trying to understand reality, I suggest we should engage with it as honestly as we can and with humility and use evidence and reason to try and understand things. knowing that we'll probably never get that exactly right. And when it comes to the ethical question, the scope is in the name, that every sentient being, any being that has the capacity for certainly valenced experiences, should matter in our moral considerations, however that we then go on to work out all the trolley problems and difficult situations we face. But I'm talking in these conversations to people whether or not they agree. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and how that plays into your work on consciousness today.
Well, to start off with my current point of view, I can read you the dedication of my upcoming book, Then I Am Myself the World. So I dedicated this book to all fellow travelers on the river of time who howl, bark, cry, screech, whine, bellow, shriek, buzz, sing, speak, or without a voice. For it is only in compassion with all life that we can redeem ourselves.
That's a wonderful start.
Clearly states where I am. So I'm Christoph Koch. I'm a physicist who over the last 30 years turned into a neurobiologist with a focus on consciousness. I was for more than 27 years a professor at the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, in Pasadena, California. And then 12 years ago, I shifted and went to Seattle, where I was chief scientist and then president of the Allen Institute for Brain Science. It's a non-for-profit institute, now 800 people focused on releasing large data sets about the human and the mouse brain and building brain observatories. And I'm also the chief scientist of the Tiny Blue Dot Foundation in Santa Monica, California. And I've always been fascinated by the question of consciousness and related topics. And I grew up in a devout Roman Catholic family. I was myself Roman Catholic. I educated my kids in the faith. But one thing that always irked me, the belief that my dogs, I always grew up around dogs, like glorious creatures, and that my dogs somehow didn't have a soul and wouldn't be resurrected in the end of time and, you know, in the eschaton. And that always bothered me because I felt, well, whatever it is, we share to a certain extent with all other creatures, in particular with dogs. And so either we all get resurrected or none of us did. So that always bothered me about my faith. And then progressively, I lost my faith. I always had challenge reconciling I lived sort of in two worlds, like many scientists do. So on Sunday, you know, you go to church and you pray and you wait for an illumination. And then during the week, the rest of the time, you're a scientist. You try to explain everything using natural explanation that reside within the universe rather than outside the universe. And so this split, this sort of schizophrenic worldview, I couldn't support anymore. And so, you know, since many years now, I'm a naturalist. I try to explain everything to the extent that we can using natural laws, whether we know them right now or whether they are still to be discovered. And so that's my point of view, which I think we share. Try to explain everything using the unfolding of ultimately what's causal power. You know, I believe what's real, the only thing that exists is causal power upon myself or upon other things, like the causal power that gravity has or the causal power that, you know, electric charge has, or, you know, the causal power that I have at whatever point I want, I raise one of my hands. That's ultimately the only thing that exists. And try to explain this vast variety of the universe, including the central aspect, which is that I can feel, I have experiences, I can see all of that as somehow arising out of ultimately causal powers.
Yeah, thank you. And many of my guests have shared some, including me, have shared some movement away from an established religion. And it's interesting that you mentioned the idea about, you know, whether dogs are ensouled and whether dogs might go to heaven, because quite often there's actually a moral rationale that is the first chink in the armor for a religious worldview. So people might look at whether it's homophobia or sexism or the concept of hell itself or wild animal suffering or, you know, do dogs have souls? And there might be something in that sort of moral kit bag that makes them think, hold on, there's something wrong here, that is the start of their journey moving away. And for others, it's more of an evidence and reason and a fact-based thing, you know, finding inconsistencies in the Bible or learning about different incompatible claims between religions. So was it more of one or the other for you, or a combination as you shifted away from that worldview?
I mean, a combination, the fact that, yes, we are supposed to treat, you know, when I asked my priest, you know, he says, of course, you're supposed to treat nature good, and we realize that other animals can suffer. And so we ought to take account of that. But ultimately, they don't have, although they're part of God's creation, they do not partake it in the same way we do. And that just felt, as I said, that just felt strange. Yes, I have a highly developed self-consciousness, and my dog doesn't have a highly developed sense of consciousness, but neither do certain severely, you know, misformed brains, or people with birth defects that have extremely limited insight, like anencephalic children, and we don't accord them any less rights because of that. And so, yeah, I mean, finally it comes down to this human exceptionalism, right? Many religions, not most, Buddhism, for instance. Many religions believe that humans are exceptional. We are in charge of the universe, and everything has to run according to our wishes, right? And everything gets subsumed or under human demands, and that struck me as wrong. And then, together with the fact, you know, so I lived for many years in other countries, like in Arab countries with Muslim majority faith, and they believe, you know, something very different. And you know, if you read who has what faith, it's totally random. It depends where you were born, in which family you were born, right? So how can this be true? And is there a true religion? And then, you know, doing science, you discover that ultimately the only thing that you can really prove, that you really know for sure, that really makes sense using rational assumptions, you know, Bayesian reasoning, et cetera, is ultimately the scientific methods, and making the smallest number of assumptions you can about what exists and what do we need to assume in order to explain everything around us. And that doesn't seem to need the demand for God that imposes particular rules on us.
Yeah, thank you. Now, one of the things I find fascinating is, even with people like you and me who have a broadly naturalistic approach to trying to understand the world, there's quite often still a strong pull back to the ideas of the transcendent or the mystical or the spiritual. So many of my guests have left a formal religion and, instead of becoming, you know, I guess just like a naturalistic atheist like me, have found themselves into something that feels maybe spiritual but not religious. And there seem to be some trigger points for those things, or some topics that draw people back towards a mystical view. And they're either, you know, origins of the universe or life or humanity, but also another classic one is consciousness itself. Are there any of those sorts of topics that sort of you still feel a pull back to something mystical or beyond or transcendent, or are you quite comfortable with a sort of more hard-edged naturalistic approach to those things?
There's the title of this next book of mine, Then I Am a Self, the World, derives from the second act of the opera Tristan und Isolde by Richard Wagner. When they undergo this mystical experience, they become essentially, they lose identity. Tristan and Isolde, these lovers, they want to merge. They lose their own identity and become one. Then I am myself, the world. Not we, but I, because there's only a single I that includes them and the entire world, which is, of course, the prototypical mystical experience.
And also a great example of IIT, so which we'll come back to later.
Yes. But it's one of a not that uncommon experience that many people have had throughout history, right? Whether it's religious conversion experiences, the classical one is, you know, Saulus on the road to Damascus, you know, encountering, you know, the living God and turning into Christianity's greatest apostle. But, you know, throughout history, people have, of any faith or of no faith, have had these mystical experiences, near-death experiences, aesthetic experiences. Schopenhauer talks about them extensively. And then today, of course, a psychedelic-induced mystical experience. So they're actually not that uncommon. And the question is, what do they reveal about the universe?
Yeah, thank you. And was the shift away from Catholicism to where you are now, did you find that easy or difficult, I guess, both psychologically in terms of family, socially?
It's not easy because, you know, if you're really devout, I mean, not just superficial, but really devout, there are many, many things that are very appealing. I mean, so I went to Jesuit school. You know, Jesuit, they have a lot of great practices, like this examination of conscience, right? Twice a day, you're supposed to systematically query yourself, why did you do what you did, to try to better understand yourself, right? There's glorious work of art. There's glorious, you know, music. So there are many things that I think are very positive about faith, in particular Catholic faith. But there, of course, there are also very negative things that and that you mentioned. But particularly if you grow up religious as a very early age, you know, it puts the roots inside of you, right? And it's not easy to leave that comfort. It's a little bit like looking back at the comfort of a childhood home suffused with warm feelings, you know, but sort of you can't go back to that. You know, yes, you have positive feelings about that, but, you know, you left that, you grew up, and now you realize that life is a tale told to adults and not a it's not a consoling tale and for children, right? The universe is beautiful, but it's also terrible, and it's up to us to make it beautiful or to understand it as a beautiful thing or as a terrible thing. It's not, there isn't a God who's going to do that for us.
Yeah, thank you. Now, one of the reasons why it can be difficult for some people links to our second big question of what matters, because a religious worldview often tells you what matters. It might be obedience to a God. It might be following a certain list of rules. And as you move away from that, some people find that difficult because you lose that moral foundation. So I'm interested in, again, I guess your story about your earliest thinking about good and bad, right and wrong, morality and ethics, and how that's changed. And I guess what your, you know, what's the foundation of your morality now, if there is such a thing?
Morality and ethics, sort of one being sort of the rules and the ethics sort of more the deeper part. How should we behave? I think ultimately it has to be to minimize the suffering of all creatures, all sentient, conscious creatures. That for me, it's the same. Sentience or consciousness are just different words denoting the same things. Creatures that can experience, given we are all product of natural selection, we all have pain and can suffer, because I think that's necessary as part of our evolutionary heritage. So I think we should strive to minimize the suffering of all creatures. Now, how do we do that and how do we adjudicate that? Particularly, how do we adjudicate among different types of creatures? I mean, we are obviously vastly more conscious than, let's say, dogs or fish or coral reef, right? And so is there a natural, you know, what the ancient called scale naturae, you know, is there a natural scale? So we can say, well, okay, 10 mice is equivalent to one dog and 50 dogs is, you know, equivalent to one human. How do we do that? I think there is, ultimately. I think it has to do with the complexity of our consciousness. Integrated information theory of consciousness, of course, gives you such a natural scale, because it says in principle you can measure the quantity of consciousness in any one specific individual. And so I think there does have to be a scaling. I mean, clearly a fly or bee, let's take a bee. Now, I used to study bees. They have roughly a million neurons compared to our roughly 100 billion neurons. So we have 100,000 times more neurons than a bee. A bee is capable of very complex action. It can recognize faces. It can do lots of complex tasks like delay match to sample. You know, it can communicate. It has this waggle dance, so it can communicate the quality of a food source to its fellow sisters back at the hive. Yet, you know, I don't think a bee who's sentient, it feels like something to be a bee. You know, a bee doesn't worry about the weekend. A bee doesn't worry about, you know, things. You know, it doesn't know about the abstract knowledge of the world or the sun in the way I do, but it feels like something. And when it dies, it doesn't feel like anything anymore. And in that's shared. I also feel something. Maybe I'm pretty sure I feel vastly more than the bee does, but ultimately we're both sentient creatures. But my conscious, if you want, the capacity I have for consciousness is vastly larger than that of a bee. And so ethics ultimately has to take account of that.
Yeah, thank you. So you've answered both of these questions, the what matters and the who matters question in one, which is neat and often happens. It's quite hard to separate these questions. But when you talk about reducing suffering, I think that's something that many people would identify with. You know, suffering, you know, may be necessary in some sense, but almost tautologically, it's a negative experience. And personally, I'm very comfortable linking the bad of experience to the bad of ethics. I'm not suggesting we can perfectly bridge the is-ought chasm, but I think that's a pretty good way of building some structure across it. How do you think about the positive aspects of experience? Because I guess one risk of focusing just on reducing or minimizing suffering is that one great way of minimizing suffering is to end sentience and existence and consciousness
altogether. How do you think about the balance of the positive and the negative of experience in ethical terms?
You want to maximize positive experiences that have to include a sense of ethics and a sense of understanding. Ultimately, I think that's key for certainly once you attain that humans, certainly adult humans, are capable of understanding their place in the universe and then transcending that understanding or accepting that and that understanding and the limited role it gives us in this universe. So those are positive experiences, including the spectacular beauty of the universe, including the fact that there's any universe at all. Because certainly, you know, it's something people rarely ask, why is there anything at all? Because from a point of view of Bayesian assumption or just basic logic, isn't the simplest thing for there to be nothing? That doesn't make any assumption, right? There's nothing there. Of course, we find ourselves in a universe, so you know, we have to acknowledge that is miraculous. We have no explanation for that. You know, we can postulate all sorts of things, either a prime mover like God, or we say it's a random fluctuation. But basically, we have no frigging idea why we're here, but that the universe is unfolding in this spectacular way, and so that's something I'm very much aware of. And as I get older, and I realize, you know, my time is short, I become more and more aware of the transient beauty of nature. You know, just this morning before we had this interview, I walked with my Bernese mountain dog in this beautiful forest here in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, just look at it. It's just spectacular, the foliage and the rain, and it's just such a thing of beauty. So we want to understand and appreciate the positive, and then we want to minimize. I think pain is essential for growth for any organism. It's, of course, also an essential driver of evolution. We do know empirically that if there are few people, unfortunate individuals, who grow up without pain sensors, right? So they have a mutation, they lack a certain sodium channel, a gene for a certain sodium channel, and so they don't have pain. Typically, they used to die young because, particularly once they get teeth, they have terrible bleedings. They constantly bite down on their tongue. They constantly overextend. They burn their fingers. You know, they're in horrible shape. And it's only recently with medicine that these people live much longer. So we know you need pain. Suffering is sort of chronic pain, you know, and also, of course, includes emotional suffering. And anyone, any creature can suffer. So I think we ought to minimize that. But yes, we should not forget that basically the universe is a beautiful, miraculous place to be, and we want to appreciate that. And that is part of the wonder that we can, right? This is so miraculous. This is truly what's mystical about the world. Particularly us, you know, us sort of matter becomes self-conscious, that we can reflect on this beautiful and terrible universe and just wonder, why is it that we are here in the first place? I don't think we know, and I don't think this question ever will have an answer, but just to engage in that.
It's quite mind-blowing, isn't it? Yes. I think it's partly mind-blowing because, you know, we didn't evolve to consider this stuff, really. We evolved for much more basic reasons. So we just seem to have been able to hack the biology into this position where we can do and think these amazing things, whether for good or for, you know, or for ill in many cases.
In fact, you could argue, you know, the anthropic principle and all of that, the fact that we live in a universe whose laws are conducive for the emergence of consciousness. I don't think for our type of, you know, for a specific Homo sapien type of consciousness, but the universe we seem to live in a type of universe that leads to long-term stable stars and planets that have stable chemicals, that then using the powers of natural, you know, selection via natural evolution gives rise to these complex systems of cells that at some point are complex enough that they become conscious. And then because they keep on, you know, evolving, they become more and more complex so they can begin to reflect upon themselves. Is that something that is that inherent? Was that inherent in this particular universe? I don't know. It's a question we can certainly ask. I don't think it has an answer, but it's a question I think we should ask.
Yeah, I agree. So, and in answering the question, so you talked about, you know, suffering or positive aspects, you know, our ability maybe to flourish is a word some people use. Those are both important. And one of the things that shifted my thinking as I've been working on this sentientism idea is I've I've tried to make it more and more clearly pluralistic, because there are different ways of thinking about morality and ethics. But to me, the common core and the central core seems to be that if morality is about anything, it's about whether and how we care about others. And there are lots of different ways you can do that. You can take a utilitarian approach where you say utility is the well-being of those others, and maybe we can measure and assess that in some way. You could take a virtue ethics approach that, you know, says kindness is a virtue or justice is a virtue. And to put that into place, we need to take account of the interests of all of these sentient others. You could take a feminist care ethic or a deontological ethic. So there's all sorts of different approaches. But I guess the core for me is to, as far as we can, try and imagine imperfectly the perspective of the other and care about the way they value their own experiences and their own lives. And we'll never do that perfectly, but that seems to be a sort of a grounding core of some sort for morality. And that links to the idea you were talking about, because I've tried to keep sentientism neutral on this idea of whether sentience can be graded or whether we should have degrees of moral consideration to reflect different types of sentience. And instead it focuses more on the boundary and says that every sentient being should matter. And that should mean at least we wouldn't needlessly harm, exploit, or kill any of those sentient beings. But that leaves enormous space, as you were talking about, for, you know, is there some sort of scala natura within that? So there are people who would agree with me on sentience being the boundary, who would actually try to take a much more egalitarian approach and say, look, once you're sentient, you matter and you should matter more equally. Others will take the approach that you follow, where you are suggesting there are gradings. I guess I'm personally quite comfortable with your sort of camp, in the sense that for me, and we'll come on to this later, I think sentience and consciousness are really sort of classes of evolved information processing in the very broadest sense. And as such, even the experiences of a single individual are multidimensional and breathtakingly complex and vary enormously over time. So when you do extend that out across a species, and certainly beyond the species boundary, the sheer range and complexity of potential sentience is overwhelming. So the idea that we should flatten that all and suggest it's one thing seems naive. So I'm quite comfortable with this dizzying variety of sentience that could then lead you into differential moral consideration as well. But I wanted to put a sort of counterpoint to you, because there are some people who will agree that there are different richnesses of sentience, but they sometimes argue that actually maybe the simpler sentience could have a more intense experience of pain or flourishing than maybe humans do, because maybe humans can mitigate those experiences in certain ways, and maybe because of our cognitive capability.
What's the evidence for that? I don't see any evidence.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's particularly strong evidence, but the one thought experiment, which may not convince you, is the idea of a chimpanzee going to the dentist. So if you go to the dentist, you understand the dentist is there to help you. You understand there's a point to the pain. You understand it will be over. You understand, you know, ultimately this is going to help you in the long term. The chimp feels and experiences none of that. So they may undergo exactly the same physical experience, but their mental experience could actually be much worse than ours.
Well, it's the same for a child. For if you have a little child where you have to cough for the same purpose, you know, or if you have a dog, sometimes you have to do things that are painful. Yes, but there's no evidence to suggest that they have a higher level of consciousness when it comes to pain than we do.
It's less about a higher level of consciousness. It's more maybe an intensity of experience.
And where should this come from? Seems like a total random assumption to me that somehow a chimp has a more random experience when it's concerned with pain than I do. Look, the basic stuff, the substrate of consciousness, at least in us, are brains, right? In chimps, in dogs, in all the creatures we've talked, even in a bee, it's a brain. And certainly if you compare across all mammals, the brains are very, very similar. This is what we show here at the Institute again and again. We have these extensive maps of the mouse brain, of the non-human primate monkey brain, of the human brain. At the level of individual cells, it's very difficult to distinguish, particularly once you remove the scale bar. It's basically all the same. It's not identical. Our cell types, for instance, are not the same as the cell types in a dog or in a mouse, because, you know, evolutionary, you know, the last common ancestor between us and a mouse was 60 million years ago. But they're remarkably similar. So I think basically that since the hardware is the substrate is so similar, our types of experiences, our classes of experience will also be similar. And I see it, it's a total random assumption that somehow in a chimp it's bigger than in me. Why? Well, I don't know. And by the way, the other thing that we have to, particularly in this day and age with ChatGPT, we also, so you use the language of information processing that I just do not, and integrated information theory does not, because now that we are birthing creatures, ChatGPT, large language models, GPT-3, GPT-4, etc., that seem to have some of the hallmarks of consciousness, right? In the sense, you can ask them, you can have a long dialogue with them, and they're getting amazingly good at it, right? And they seem to have, of course, they've been trained to strenuously deny that they're conscious, but that's just, you know, the guardrails that big tech puts on them not to scare us. But, you know, you can engage with them in a way like with another very intelligent, highly literary person. So the question, are they conscious? And if they're conscious, do they also have moral rights? Are they sentient? And so according to IoT, so the big fault line in modern attitudes towards, consciousness is really computational functionalism, that people in most theories and most big tech, the way they think about it, things like consciousness, ultimately it's a function. It's a function that can be replicated either in brains, in different types of brains, but also in computers. It has a particular function, and once you replicate that function, everything else follows from that. So in particular, that computation is sufficient for consciousness, that if you have a properly programmed machine, and now, you know, if you have a properly programmed computer, that computer ultimately will be conscious. And people have argued, is ChatGPT there, or maybe not quite there, and the next year it's going to be there, but either it's already there, or very soon it will be there. Versus the taking an attitude that's sort of more fundamental, that takes more structural, more closer to idealism, that said, no, ultimately consciousness is a state of being. It has nothing to do with function, although evolutionary it may be associated with function. But ultimately, it's a state of being. It's not about processing. It's not about codes. It's not about computation. It's a state of being in a particular, very complex physical systems. And certainly all these computers today, ChatGPT, and even in 10 years from now, when they're much more intelligent than we are, they're not conscious. So I would say there's no question that these machines can be as intelligent as we are, and ultimately, of course, much smarter than we are, right? Super intelligent, but they're not conscious, they're not sentient. So therefore, they have no moral rights.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to come back to digging into that in a little bit as well. But if I can pull you back to this who matters question, because I think you and I share this, if you like, a sentiocentric stance that says any being that has the capacity to have experiences should matter in our moral consideration. And I'm interested in, I guess, two things. One is, you know, your personal journey to realizing that. How early did that start, with whether it was companion animals or something else that took you beyond that human centrism we talked about? And how that has developed, and whether that's been an easy or a difficult journey. But I'm also interested in the implications of that start as well, and how you might have worked those through in your own life too. So again, you can wind the clock back to sort of tell the story about how you started to realize that non-humans matter too.
It's companion animals, and in my case, dogs. I mean, I'm biased for dogs because I grew up around dogs, but it's, you know, anyone who's around, you know, animals that are closely related to us, like dogs and cats and pigs and lambs and horses and other mammals. I'm now restricting myself to mammals. I'm not saying other creatures aren't, but those are the ones that typically we have as companion animals. When you see them suffer, you feel terrible, right? And I've never met a pet owner. So I've met a lot of people who are skeptical about, you know, what is truly conscious, and does consciousness, you know, can computers have it? Does consciousness require a soul? But I've never met a pet owner who denies that their companion animal isn't conscious, or at least doesn't share the same sort of thing that they have, maybe to a lesser extent. So if you grow up with animals, not just as utility on the farm, but, you know, with animals that you interact with, you automatically assume, well, of course they're conscious, you know, not in the same way we are, but of course they have desires, They have needs that you need to attend to, right? And you want to minimize their suffering. And then what happened, I had this interview with Susan Blakemore, famous British scientist, and she asked me out of the blue, we're talking about animal consciousness and why we study mice and all of that. And then she says, out of the blue, do you still eat meat? And that stopped me cold because I did.
Yeah.
And then I didn't say anything. And then she just says, tastes too good, doesn't it? And that sort of shamed me, deeply shamed me. And a month later, or 2 months later, I had this beloved black German shepherd called Nosy. She died in my arms, and I was so distraught. I gave her comfort as she was dying. And I thought, how is it possible I can be so distraught with the death of this creature while a lamb or a pig that's not that different in terms of brain size and complexity, I love to eat? This doesn't seem right. And that very night, it's now almost 20 years ago, I decided I will never eat, to honor her memory, Nosy's memory, I will never eat, you know, the flesh of another conscious creature again. And I haven't. And so, you know, this is sort of a personal experience that allowed me finally to take this step to act, you know, to not do things like eat other animals needlessly.
Yeah. And it's a fascinating journey, because I think most humans would agree with you and me that it's not just humans that matter, either because they have a companion animal or because some experiences with wild animals. Or so I think most humans would agree. The problem is that most humans work backwards from the implications and use those to limit their philosophy rather than thinking about the implications of their philosophy and rolling those through. And that's very hard to do, because we live in a society that is very human-centric and that normalizes animal agriculture or animal exploitation at a breathtaking scale. It doesn't just normalize them, but tells us they're good. So that's really hard to break through, to actually make a change as a result of a latent sentiocentric ethic that most people already have.
I think that's the great sin that our modern civilization does. You know, we think ourselves morally so superior than all previous because we recognize, you know, racism and misogyny and other types of ism. But then, you know, we have this large-scale industrial production of animals, billions of animals every day, every year, that we slaughter and keep under totally inhumane conditions. And so that's the big stain of 21st century modern civilization.
I think
which
right.
We could do, of course, and it's also really bad for the environment. We know that we could get rid of it, but we don't.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's another one of those things that we will look back on with abject horror. Yeah. Yes. Now, there's another barrier in that process, because it's not a simple one-stage process. There's another barrier that, frankly, I was stuck on for a while. I'd be interested in your views too, because I went vegetarian in my mid-20s, I think. And I think the reason I stopped at vegetarianism was, one, because of the visceral directness of actually putting a piece of an animal in your mouth, right? I mean, it's so incontrovertible. You can't get away from the implications of that, in a sense. Whereas for some other types of animal products, it's a bit less direct. So you can sort of kid yourself, it's okay. But it was also a social calibration, because at that point, I mean, being vegetarian was seen as a bit weird. But being, you know, going beyond that to boycotting all animal products and being vegan was seen as really weird. So it was a combination of those two things that sort of left me in that stage. And eventually I sort of allowed myself to learn about dairy and eggs and leather and everything else. And I've been vegan for, I guess, 6 or so years now. How do you think about sort of going beyond vegetarianism and, I guess, the animal agriculture industry as a whole, not just, you know, the meat bits of it? And I don't, you know, there's limited point in me. I don't want to sort of audit your own personal choices, but I find it fascinating how we think these things through and the paths people are on.
Yeah, I mean, I've been inconsistent. I've asked myself this several times over the last several months, because someone else also asked me why you're not a vegan. And the answer is, I haven't really thought much about it. I don't really have a good answer to that.
Well, I was thinking about it for 25 years. In fact, I was not thinking about it for 25 years, to be honest. I just avoided the topic. It was easier.
Yeah, it is easy, of course, not thinking about it. But now, of course, you could make an argument. The reason, for example, bees, right? So I've talked to people about bees and honey, that we shouldn't use honey, we shouldn't eat honey because, you know, it's a product of animals, bees. But of course, you can make the counter argument. Do you know the book by Michael Pollan, The Omnivore's Dilemma?
Yeah.
Right. He's written very eloquently about that, where he goes, you know, he starts off going with his son to a McDonald's, gets ultimately disgusted by that, turns into a vegetarian, but then comes back and says, well, on a limited condition, like if you hunt the creature, if that creature has a normal lifespan, you know, and then you hunt it and kill it quickly and then eat it, that's very different. And also, of course, he says, well, if we don't use any of these animals, they probably wouldn't be around today, right? Would bees really be around in their large numbers if we don't cultivate them for their honey? But I don't know. I confess, I have not deeply thought about veganism.
Well, one recommendation is one of my recent interviews is with the philosopher John Sambon Matsu, and he's written a book called The Omnivore's Deception, which directly responds to pollen. So that might be a good piece of reading for you.
Wait, The Omnivore's Deception?
Yeah, fascinating. My nervousness is that there's one of the things us humans are brilliant at is finding justifications, post-rationalizations for the things we want to keep doing. And I feel that pollen's work, you know, fits convincingly into that space. But let's leave that there for the moment. But thank you for being so open about, you know, where you're thinking on that topic. Where we should go next, I guess, is to delve into, because I guess you and I agree with that, you know, consciousness and sentience is not just intellectually fascinating, and but it's also of deep moral significance. You know, that's why other beings, human and not, matter. So an obvious follow-on question is, okay, well, what is it? And you've already said that you tend to use consciousness and sentience as pretty equivalent terms. And I tend to as well. I guess the reason I've focused more on sentience, and I think much of moral philosophy sometimes focuses on sentience, is partly as a resistance to something I think you also challenge, which is that many people, when they talk about consciousness, want to load lots of extra stuff into it. They want to put self-reflection or ability to plan for the future or language or cognitive capabilities and blah, blah, blah. And I don't mind if people want to do that, but the danger is that draws the idea of consciousness back to something that only humans have.
How convenient.
Yeah, it is. We're good at this stuff, as I've said. Whereas for me, sentience seems to be the morally salient component of consciousness, if it isn't just all of consciousness, in that it is just that capacity to have experiences.
It's a capacity to have experiences. And you're right. Many people specialize that. They say, well, it's capacity to have experience about the self, which is really self-consciousness. So self-consciousness is a subset of all conscious experience that little children don't have, babies don't have, and most animals don't have. You know, most animals don't have a lot of reflection upon self. They do have a self, you know, it's a mirror test and all of that, but it's clearly vastly more limited than us. While we sort of have this hypertrophied sense of self and, of course, of importance of self. But it's all, ultimately, it's all about feelings. It's about experience, subjectivity, phenomenology, however you call it. It's all the same.
Yeah. Makes sense. And what's, if you wouldn't mind, I'd be fascinated in your latest view of the science of what some call the correlates of consciousness, or, you know, where do we find these processes operating in brains and nervous systems? What's the latest thinking about where that is and how that operates and how these states that you call conscious come into being and how they operate?
Well, okay, so those are different questions. So first of all, there's a modern approach that I work with Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of DNA, you know, who got the Nobel Prize with Jim Watson many years ago. And we came up with this sort of pragmatic programs. And okay, philosophy, you know, it's been arguing about this for the past 2,400 years. So that's all good and fine, but hasn't gotten anywhere. So let's just forget about that and focus on an empirical program on discovering what most people will agree, no matter where, what particular ism they believe. What are the footprints of consciousness in the brain? We know, unlike previous cultures, it's not in the heart, right? You know, you love with your heart. or you know, there are all these sacred heart academies around, right? There's no sacred brain academy around. You don't love with your brain. You never give your sweetheart for Valentine's a little brain, a little hypothalamus. No, you give her a heart-shaped chocolate.
I'm going to try the brain thing next Valentine's Day. So.
I don't think they make, well, there's probably some specialty company on the web that makes them. So we know it's a brain. And so you can ask the question, which bits and pieces of the brain are necessary? So, for example, your eyes. You know, we all, as humans, we have very elaborate visual consciousness. I open my eyes, I see all of this scene. I can close my eyes, I can dream, I can have hallucination, I can take magic mushrooms and see fantastic scenes, etc. So what is it for visual consciousness? Are my eyes involved? Turns out, no, because precisely I can have very vivid dreams at night when you know, I sleep in the dark, my eyes are closed. Is that the spinal cord involved? No, it's not. Is the cerebellum, so most of your brain, most of your neurons, you roughly have 100 billion neurons, most of them, roughly, you know, 75% or so are in this tiny brain in the back called the cerebellum. You can lose it due to surgery, or some people are born, very few individuals are born without a cerebellum. You move very funnily, you know, you look like you're drunk, you have ataxia, you know, you can't find your nose anymore, etc., but you're still fully conscious. And so we know from clinical experience, and now increasingly from animal experiments, particular bits and pieces of the brain are much more closely tied to consciousness than to others. And so you can, this is a scientific program discovering the neural correlates of consciousness that ultimately will be successful. We will discover, it's still controversial right now. In fact, I recently lost a bet, a famous bet against David Chalmers in New York City in June of this year, bet I made 25 years ago. Well, I, as brash young scientist, believing in, you know, and we now have all the tools we need. We have fMRI, we have microelectrodes and all of that. We're, sure, Dave, in 25 years from now, we'll have knocked it out of the park and the community will agree, this bit of brain, if you lose it, you're not going to be conscious anymore. Turns out the community hasn't agreed yet. And so I handed him over 6 bottles of very good Madeira wine that was 35 years old. But David Chalmers, this is the guy with the heart problem, right? He admits this problem will have a solution. This is not part of the heart problem, right? So what he means by the heart problem is explaining why should anything physical, why should a brain exude consciousness but not the heart, or why, you know, why should a particular computation, or why should a particular behavior be associated with consciousness but not something else? That consciousness is really a fact above and beyond our understanding of the natural world. So you can imagine his famous zombie argument. You can imagine everything in the world is to be true except you and I aren't conscious, we're zombies. There's nothing in natural law, there's nothing in general relativity, in quantum mechanics as construed right now, in chemistry and biology, that would argue there's some logical flaw with this world. So it's certainly possible. So consciousness is a fact above and beyond our current conceived notion of consciousness. So he admits that finding the correlates, that we will get there sooner or later. We haven't gotten there yet, so you lost your bet, Christoph, but ultimately, you know, ultimately this will be something we will understand. So the only thing you can have against that is to say, well, Dave, once you have a properly construed theory of consciousness that isn't just a correlate. So that's why Crick and I use the term correlate, because correlate is neutral with respect to, are you a dualist? Are you an epiphenomenalist? Are you, you know, a computational functionalist, right? Independent of these isms, most people agree, yes, there will be some parts of the brain that are going to be critically involved and other parts not. But ultimately, I think you need a theory that says, given what exists, given what we can know, this is what consciousness is. This is how the physics of a piece of matter has to be in order for it to be conscious. And that's why certain pieces of matter, like my iPhone, don't have it, but other pieces of matter, like my dog or like you and I, have it. And so this is what IIT tries to do, integrated information theory of consciousness tries to accomplish or accomplishes.
Yeah, thank you. And what's the latest on those correlates? What, you know, where in the brain is the root of it? Because I've one of the other interesting lenses on this topic is that of evolution and how did animal consciousness evolve. And I've been lucky to interview Mark Solms and Walter Veit, who've done fascinating work on this. I know Mark's view is that the real seat of foundational consciousness is quite deep in the brain. Then there are people like Jablonka and Ginsberg who've worked on concepts like unlimited associative learning as sort of markers for it, but I don't think they have a necessary view on the neurology. But is there a sense of where these bits actually sit within our heads?
Yeah, so you can talk to neurosurgeons. They're directly relevant because they have to take out bits and pieces of the brain. Because you have tumor, you have a stroke, or you have a bleeding, or there's, you know, blood pressure, or an epileptic foci. And so you can ask them, well, which bit of brain you can take out? Well, if you take out the brainstem, you die. So the brainstem, and here I disagree with Mark Solms, the brainstem is absolutely necessary for you to live, no question about it. If you have a tumor there, it's pretty bad news. If you have a stroke there, it's also pretty bad news. But it's just like same with the heart. If you don't have a heart, if your heart stops, if one of us has a heart attack, within 7 seconds you lose consciousness, literally. You faint. That's what it is. You lose consciousness. But nobody would say the heart is the correlate of consciousness. No one would say that the hemoglobin molecules that transport the life-giving, you know, the energy-sustaining oxygen to the brain cells so they can do their work is a correlate of consciousness. Same thing with the brainstem. The brainstem Francis Crick and I call this enabling factor. It's a background condition. It's a critical background condition that needs to be there. Just like this laptop right now, this runs our Zoom, has power. If the power fails, none of the operating system operate, you know, all the complex computation that goes on in order for us to have the Zoom call doesn't exist anymore. But that's not due to the battery. The battery provides the life-giving juice. So it is with the brainstem. And neurosurgeon, and the majority of opinion, certainly in neuroscience, it's caught in humans and in mammal, in not neurotypical, you have to be very careful, in neurotypical people, so people like you and I who grew up with a relatively normal brain, and in other mammals, it's really the outermost layer that makes us sort of unique. It's called the neocortex. It's a layer, it's like a pizza. It's like 12 to 14 inch across. It's like a pizza, 2 to 3 millimeters thick and highly convolved. And that is the structure that gives rise to to seeing and hearing and being in pain and being in pleasure, etc. But even there, it turns out you can take out large part of the frontal lobe, and people do not lose consciousness. Yes, they might it will impact their moral reasoning, their decision making. They really do stupid stuff, but they can certainly talk as long as you don't remove the inferior left frontal gyrus. They can certainly tell you that they are conscious. If you take out part of the back of the cortex, typically that's, again, bad news, and people won't see or won't hear or won't be able to, have a bodily experience. So I would say right now the majority of opinion seems to converge is the back part of posterior cortex. The back part of cortex called posterior cortex, that's really critical for consciousness. And then, of course, you have to ask, well, why? Why is it, if it's true that, you know, okay, so let's say cortex is this pizza that you unfold, why is there this polarity? Why is one part of the pizza, the front part, doesn't give rise to consciousness and the back what does? Well, very likely it has to do with the way it's constituted. Not the types of cells, because they are similar, not the same, but they are similar. But the big difference is the connectivity. And ultimately, I think it's the connectivity that gives rise to, and the type of connectivity that's critically involved, that also makes us unique with respect to, let's say, computers that have a radical different connectivity, which is why digital computers as currently built are not conscious in the way you and I are. Now, two things to caveat. That does not mean that if you never had a cortex, like certain children that are born with a defect, so-called anencephalic children, they will never talk, they will never speak. You know, they're severely intellectual incapacitated. They may have some other structures that replace certain amount of consciousness. It's very difficult because it's very limited interaction with these individuals. So they may have.
But they do seem to show some level of emotional responsiveness and
Incorrect. So the question is that automatic? Is that just an unconscious reflex or is that conscious? It's very difficult. If you ask the parents, of course, they'll tell you, of course, as they should, but whether it's really consciousness, it's an edge case, very difficult to adjudicate. But most emphatically, it does not mean that creatures that haven't evolved a real cortex, like bees, we're talking about bees. I think they're wonderful creatures. They don't have anything close to a, you know, because they're on a very different evolutionary path. Or an octopus, you know, you can see all those beautiful videos of octopus doing incredible, or squid, you know, cephalopods doing very complicated behaviors. They're very complicated nervous system, but they don't have a cortex. But there's another structure that has similar connectivity that I think in their case is a substrate of consciousness. But in us, in mammals, it tends to be the cortex.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So it's and it's clear from your response that capacity for consciousness is not bound to a specific architecture, for example, in octopuses and bees versus humans in the brain, but it does require a certain level and connectivity and complexity and integration.
That's correct.
And that's probably a nice link into the second part of this question, because as you said, thinking about the correlates of consciousness is somewhat independent of philosophy of mind, whereas IIT does step more into that world and is more a theory of what consciousness actually is. So again, it would be really interesting for those of my audience who aren't familiar with IIT, if you could sort of do a sort of beginner's guide to it. But I'm also interested in how you think it does link to some of these sort of established philosophies of mind, whether they be, you know, functionalism and computationalism, illusionism, panpsychism, various forms of dualism. You know, how does IIT fit in? Because it seems fascinating to me as an amateur, because it seems to be a theory that is criticized by people from lots of different philosophies of mind, but it also seems to be attractive to people from different philosophies of mind as well. So it doesn't necessarily fit the portfolio of choices that are classically presented that cleanly.
That's correct. So A, because it doesn't arise out of philosophy. It's not that, you know, so Giulio Tononi, it's an Italian American psychiatrist, neuroscientist at the University of Madison in Wisconsin, who's sort of the chief architect of it. He didn't start off and say, okay, this is my philosophical belief. Let's say I'm a panpsychist, or I'm a dualist, or I'm idealist, and let's build a system. No, they looked at the brain and try to understand from a physical point of view. I'm very sympathetic, and I work with him or continue to work with him. So I'm very sympathetic to this point of view. He starts out with consciousness. So all other theories, including the early sort of theorizing that Francis Crick and I did, we had this famous, very well in the field known hypothesis. There was this discovery in the late 1980s that certain states in animals, when they're conscious, is associated with this high frequency oscillation in 40 hertz. And it's in the EG band called the gamma band. And so it's sometimes called the 40 hertz or the gamma band hypothesis, that if you see activity in this particular frequency range, it's associated with consciousness, okay? Well, then you can ask the question, well, why 40 hertz? Why not 30 hertz? Why is it 42? Is it like, you know, 42, the answer of life, universe, and everything else? Or is it 50? It seems rather random that 40 hertz suddenly magically gives, so clearly, why? But that, if you think about it, every other theory has the same Achilles heel. So some theory says, well, it's got to be the collapse of the wave function. Well, then you have to ask why the collapse of the wave function. Or you say it's a broadcasting, like global neural workflow. It's a broadcasting. Well, what is it about broadcasting? If I have a bullhorn and I broadcast to all my neighborhood, why should that suddenly be conscious? Other people said it's feedback. Well, there's feedback everywhere. There's feedback in all of my, in every single one of cells of my body, there's feedback. It's just any feedback. There's feedback in the loop between my temperature sensor here and the heating system. Is that conscious? So, and all those theories, on the one hand, they say ultimately it's an event, or it's a type of activity, or it's a type of computation that ultimately sort of they just postulate is that's what consciousness is. So it's, to me, it's like you take the brain and you try to squeeze the juice of consciousness out of, use poetic language, you turn the waters of the brain by really squeezing, you turn them into the wine of consciousness, and that seems like a miracle. IIT is different. IIT says, let's start with consciousness. What really exists ultimately is consciousness. And then there are certain things. Every conscious experience is of a particular type. It's for me. It's intrinsic. It's not for you. It's for me. It's specific. You know, it is a conscious experience. It is. It's one. It's integrated. It's holistic. It has various parts. You know, there's you and there's a screen and there's a left and right and up and down and all of that. And it's definite. It is the way it is. It's not more. I don't have conscious access of to my blood pressure, and it's not less. It is exactly what it is right now. These seem sort of indubitable properties of any conscious experience, whether it's a psychedelic or a pain or a dream or hallucination. All of them are sort of specific, differentiated, integrated, holistic, and definite. And then it says, well, it also makes a point. It also starts with ontology, what exists. What truly exists is what has causal power. And causal power upon itself, that's intrinsic. That's ultimately what consciousness is. Causal power upon others, that's what physics is all about. You know, like gravity has causal power upon others. But any system that has causal power upon itself, that ultimately, that's sort of the first or the zeroth order postulate, that is what consciousness is. It's intrinsic, it's upon me. Any system that has causal power upon itself feels like something. And now you take those axioms and try to express them in terms of causal power. What does it mean for causal power to be intrinsic, to be definite, to be unitary? And so then you end up with this calculus that says, well, so causal power is just, it's very operational. It's just the ability, you're in a current state, you know, you have a system with neurons or transistors, whatever, some are on, some are off. And it has what we call transition probability matrix, right? You're in a particular state, and with certain probabilities, you go into that state or into that state. And causal power is the ability to control that. How many states from your current state, the future state, how likely is that going to be different from a random distribution? If it's random, then you have no causal power upon yourself. If my current brain has no power to determine the next state, then it may as well not exist. In fact, that's what existence is. It goes back to a comment of Plato in Phaedon in the dialogue. And so ultimately it says consciousness is causal. You take a substrate like a brain or like a computer chip or like anything else, and you look at all the various causal relationship within, and you determine which structure that maximizes the causal power. And this causal power, it's called, the maximum is called integrated information. It has a number, the Greek symbol phi. And you can also think of it as an irreducibility of a system, as a substrate, like, let's say, the posterior part of my cortex has a maximum phi. That's where my consciousness is. That's associated with myself. It's sort of maximal irreducible. You cannot reduce it into a simpler component. If you could, then it wouldn't be that whole. So that's how you define whole. So it's very particular about what exists. What exists for itself, which is the only existence worth having, because that's intrinsic existence for me. When I'm in a deep sleep, I don't exist for me. When I'm anesthesia, I don't exist for me. I only exist for me when I'm conscious. So that's true, absolute existence. When I'm asleep, not in a dream, but in a deep sleep, unconscious, I still exist for others. I can still exert some causal power. My body still has mass, and I might be still moving around, you know, and my wife can observe my sleeping body, but I don't exist for myself anymore. I can just snore, that's right. So I do have some effect on others, but all of that's unconscious. So the only existence worth having is that's true existence. It's existence for the thing itself. So that's ultimately what consciousness is. It's any system, any physical substrate that has causal power upon itself feels like something. How much it feels, it's quantified by this number phi. And what it feels, you know, the fact that space is extended, that time flows, that objects have sort of certain sense of permanence, that they come in particular colors, etc., that's all determined from the unfolded causal power of the substrate. And the theory is very radical. It says consciousness is one-to-one. It's called an identity relationship. The causal powers of this system that has maximum cause-effect power upon itself, you unfold these causal powers. that ultimately is identical to any one conscious experience. It doesn't, it's not proportional, it doesn't correlate. That's what conscious experience is. It's this unfolded causal power. So in that sense, consciousness is ultimately a structure.
Yeah.
It's a state of being. It's not a state of doing. It's a state of being. Being in love or being angry or whatever. That's what ultimately what consciousness is.
Yeah. So it doesn't take a dualist path of saying there's some separate thing, which is consciousness, because consciousness and the causal powers are identity, are just one thing.
So it's not a classical dualist. It's not an emergent. It's not dualist. It does have some panpsychist implications, some, because it says that, for instance, it may well be that single cells, you know, if you take a single amoeba, it's vastly complex, you know, it has maybe 10,000 different proteins in there, a billion molecules. No one has ever modeled it on a computer because it's vast complexity. It may well be that this little single cell feels an itsy bitsy bit like something, not a lot, but it feels like something. So in that sense, it's more permissive of consciousness in non-standard system. But unlike panpsychism, it doesn't say, it's very particular because it says the borders of conscious system have to be always this maximum. So for example, two cells are not conscious as an entity. Chairs aren't conscious. You know, maybe the individual grains of it feels an itsy bitsy like something, but most things are not conscious because it has this very precise ontology of saying what exists. What exists are these maxima of causal power. So for example, you exist for yourself. I exist for myself, but there isn't any super consciousness. There isn't any superordinate consciousness between you know, Jamie, Christoph, right? Because there's a local consciousness, there's a local maximum of integrated information here and in your brain, but there isn't anything above and beyond that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess, as you say, it has some affinity with panpsychism, but I think with some versions of panpsychism, and I've spoken to people like Luke Roloff's, Emerson Green, David Pierce, who sort of favor that view, they won't say a table is conscious either for related reasons, but they will still suggest that consciousness itself is, if you like, a foundation of physics and primordial in that sense. So they would look at, they might respond to what you've said and say, well, in a sense, an electron buzzing around the nucleus has some minimal causal power as it jumps shells or keeps spinning around, or
it's the same thing. It starts fundamentally, what exists is causal powers, which includes, of course, sort of what we call the laws of physics, you know, gravity and you know, electrodynamic strong and weak forces. But it's very precise. I mean, panpsychism is a philosophy, you know, it doesn't give us, so for instance, the big argument against it, why aren't we conscious? There's you and I, as I just said, but there isn't an uber conscious. Well, panpsychism doesn't explain that. It doesn't say where the exact borders.
The combination problem, yeah.
Yes, the combination problem. Well, IT says it's very precise. So, for instance, it makes this thought experiment. Let's say I start putting brains between neurons or wires, let's say Neuralink technology, between my brain and your brain. So I start connecting using some fancy technology, my brain to your brain, okay? And IIT says there's come, which is really the inverse of what happens in a split brain experiment. To remind the audience, split brain experiment. So you have two cortical hemispheres. They're interconnected with a structure called corpus callosum that contains roughly 200 million axons, 200 million fibers that link the left brain with the right brain. In certain cases of epileptic seizures, this operation is still done today, although rarely, to prevent the spread of seizures from, let's say, one hemisphere into the other hemisphere, you cut the corpus callosum. It's called a split brain operation. And then, you know, there are now, as far as we can tell, there are two consciousness in one skull. There are two conscious entities in one skull. So now think about the opposite. I take your brain and my brain and build this artificial corpus callosum. IT says there comes a very precise point when I add one more wire, at which point the integrated information between your brain and my brain now exceeds by some little iota the integrated information just in your brain or just in my brain. At that point, Jamie will disappear. Consciousness of Christoph will disappear. Instead, there will be this new entity, this amalgamation of Christoph, Jamie, a single conscious being, right? whose borders extend across four hemispheres, that can speak through two mouths and has four limbs, you know, or eight limbs.
And annoy both of our wives.
Yes, and also we would probably have major, you know, psychiatric disorders, right? Because, you know, now suddenly, you know, you take two individuals that grew up their entire life in their own skulls and suddenly you force them using this artificial means to go together. So it's probably a case of borderline. I don't know what psychiatric symptoms there will be. But anyhow, so this is the beauty of having a scientific theory versus just a philosophy. You can make very precise where are the borders.
Yeah, thank
you. Between my consciousness and your consciousness or any consciousness.
Now, when you talk about causal powers, you're not talking about those in some sort of non-deterministic libertarian free will sense. You are talking
about an aspect
of the operation of the laws of nature. So what is it that distinguishes the causal power of an electron spinning around an atom or a ball rolling down a hill from what you call, you know, is it just a question of degree about the richness of those causal powers or the...
Well, so you have to have, is it causal power upon others or is it causal powers upon yourself? So, you know, so there's a huge difference. Causal powers upon others, like electron, you know, has a charge and has causal powers upon others. But consciousness, according to IIT, is causal power upon yourself. So you have some system and you define a system using what's most concrete, the transition probability matrix. You say, well, the system consists out of these elements, two electrons or 100 billion human neurons. And then you systematically, in principle at least, compute the transition probability. If those two neurons are off and those billions of neurons are on, then over the next 10 milliseconds, these neurons will turn on and off, right? And from that, you can compute the intrinsic power. So it's a very operational, it's a very physical view. Ultimately, all there is transition probability matrices. That's one way to think about reality that sort of instantiate causal powers upon others. That's the laws of physics, or upon oneself, this is what consciousness is.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah, the other question I had for you before I ask you how to solve all of the world's problems in our final question is, you described consciousness earlier on as a state rather than a process. And I guess, to me, the idea of a state feels static or frozen in some sense, whereas my intuition about consciousness is that it is more about something that is an ongoing process where information moves around and things happen and that causal process unfolds upon itself. Let me put this another way. I guess my intuition is that, you know, we're evolved animals. What's going on in our brains is not some sort of simple computational process, but ultimately, broadly defined, I think it is a sort of very broadly defined computational process that includes neuron firing and chemical waves and various other things going on that could then be instantiated in a different sort of substrate. And your response to that is, well, it's not information processing, it's not a process, it's a state. What would I be missing in that sort of attempt to be more functionalist?
Well, because ultimately it's not about a function. Look, you can have what Buddhist monks call pure presence. Okay, so they do these long-term meditators that do this for 30 years, you know, 5,000 hours or more of meditation. They go into the state of pure presence where they may be, you know, for 10 minutes, where they claim, if you take the claim seriously, that they're conscious, yet they have no content. All right, so let's just accept that at face value. Or you can do like things like 5-MeO-DMT, you know, the toad. We can have a near-death experience where also time comes to stand. There's no more flow of time, right? You perceive it as a moment in now that doesn't have any duration anymore. Nothing happens. There's just a state of pure experience. Now, that's extremely rare. And so our intuition is the fact that, well, because we know this is why meditation is so difficult. There are constantly thoughts going on in my head, right? We know it's very difficult to just quiet your mind because we evolved creatures. We're constantly thinking about the past and futures and threats and what do I need to do and all of that. And that's our intuition. But you don't have to think like that. You can ultimately try to train yourself to remain in one single state. And you can even make this prediction. So IT makes this prediction. If you have a brain that's completely quiet, that's silent, that probably corresponds to what the Buddhists call this pure presence, that brain, looking down at it from an external point of view, from an external observer, PUS, let's say neuroscientist, no neurons are firing. Now take another brain that's very similar that I've poisoned using anesthesia, let's say. Both brains, there's no neural activity going on. One brain, it's not poison. It just is in a state like pure presence where there are no neurons active. The other brain has lost its causal power because I injected this external anesthesia and it cannot fire. But looking down from the external point of view, both look identical. Neither of them shows any neural activity. IT says the former, the brain that could fire but doesn't fire, just like, you know, Sherlock Holmes' dog in the, you know, the famous short story, right, that could bark but didn't bark. This brain chooses not to fire and is in a particular state but has a potential to fire. The other brain, you removed its causal power but poisoning it. So that brain isn't conscious. That's the difference. It's not a computation. There's no in a pure presence, there's no computation. You're not computing anything. You're not predicting anything. You're just in this state of being. Yes, computation is useful. Yes, computers do it. Yes, under certain views, you can also think of the brain as doing computation. That's sort of the entire modern paradigm. But consciousness is not, it's not a computation.
Yeah, thank you. That's a fascinating view. Yeah. So in the time we've got left, I'm going to ask you one more crazily big question, which is, how do we make a better world? I know you've only got 5 minutes to answer it, so this should be easy. But in you used a really beautiful Paul Gauguin quote. You know, you're fascinated by, you know, where do we come from? Who are we? And where are we going? And I guess I'd like to add another one onto that, which is, where should we be going? And you and I have just made the problem much, much worse for ourselves, because we're not just talking about 8 billion human sentient beings. We're now also talking about trillions of maybe sentient beings under human control in labs and in farms and in our cities and our towns, in our homes. But we're also even more radically considering maybe even free-ranging or wild animals, which could take us into the quintillions or sextillions as well. So we've made the scope of our moral problem about progress and trying to make things better even harder. So I'm interested, one, whether you have any sort of big picture thoughts about value and meaning, because I know that's a topic that you keep returning to. But then maybe we can also get a bit more specific about how you see the role of science and your type of work playing into trying to make a better world, ideally for all sentient beings.
Look, I don't have any leave the world a better place than you found it. It's very humble. I think we have to take a humble attitude here, you know, rather than making grand pronouncement about what how people should have, try to leave the world a better place, you know, use whatever influence you have to minimize the suffering of all creatures. I think that's all we can do. But I think if everyone does that, and try, as you emphasized early on, try to understand we all live in what Elizabeth Koch calls perception box of our own making. And we have to realize that other people have a different view of the same facts. It's like the dress, you know, the famous dress that went viral. Yeah, half of humanity sees it as blue, black stripe, and the other half of as white, yellow. And there is no fact of the matter. There is no true color. It's a construct of our brain, and some people construct it one way and other people construct it the other way. And so it is with everything. You know, if we look at the terrible war going on in Gaza, you know, it's not that one is right and one is wrong. But people are heavily polarized. So we have to try to understand to the best of our abilities, which of course is limited, to try to understand the point of view of the other, which is not just the other person, but also the other in more radical form, the other animals that suffer here and that of course never spoken about.
Yeah. And it returns to our discussion about morality, that I think that it really is the central imperative, is to try and understand the other. And your work on consciousness research is helping us do that more radical step of recognizing that it's not just humans that have a perspective that we should take account of.
Others, correct. There are many, many other others, many more than at least we are taught in traditional Western canon.
Yeah, Absolutely. So thank you. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to add in? We've answered what's real, who matters, and how to make a better world. And what is consciousness?
Yes, so I think we've covered a lot of ground. Thank you much, Jamie, for having me.
What's the best way of people following you and reading your books? I'll include some links to your website and so on in the show notes. But
I don't Twitter. I'm not on social media. If you include a link, I have an upcoming book, but it won't be out for another 5 months. Then I'm Myself the World, where I talk more about these topics, and particularly as they relate to mystical experiences.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Thank you very much. And I will follow up offline with my tips on completing your vegan transition. It's never been easier. So we'll work on it together.
Yeah, The Omnivore Deception. I have to read that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. John will help
Thank
you
too. Much.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for being a guest on Sentientism.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?